It's really interesting to see. One of the things about the United Kingdom versus America is that the fans here are much, much more serious than in America. Okay. So there are two teams fairly close by. One of them would rhyme with Barstool and the other one with Ottenham. Anyway, you have a choice. You can choose one or the other. That's how it works. And once you choose one, you can't unchoose that choice ever. For the rest of your life, you must be one of those fans, and you can't jump. You certainly cannot jump to the other side. That is terribly, terribly wrong. Okay. Now, I am what you would call a terrible fan, meaning throughout the course of my life, if I've moved somewhere, I've totally flipped who I root for. Just like that. Oh, I moved to a different town. I'm rooting for somebody else. But I do have one particular rule for how I choose who I'm going to be a fan of. And that is, I usually root for the underdog because I think that the normal person is arrogant. They're just arrogant, and this team is arrogant, and they're full of themselves, and I want them to lose, and so I want the underdogs to win. That's usually how I choose my teams. And so here we have a few teams that spend like five times the amount of everybody else, and I universally root against them because I think they carry themselves with such pride. We're just naturally going to win, and it irritates me. Now, I want us to think about, as we return to Genesis, this idea of pride and arrogance and, you know, the reaction of like, I dislike that. I'm rooting against that. This story that we have before us about Babel and then the lineage is designed to tell us that God kind of feels the same way as me, in a way. That he really dislikes, in fact, abhors pride and arrogance so much so that, unlike me, where I just wish that the underdogs would win, God gets up and he says, actually, I'm going to do something about this. I will bring the proud down and I will lift up the humble. And he doesn't just do this once. He just does this. This is what God does. I will bring the proud down. And I will lift the humble up. So let's just start by seeing how God brings down the proud. That's the first section that we have in front of us that we didn't read because I thought we would read it just now. So this is in verse 1 of chapter 11, first book of the Bible. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used bricks instead of stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So on first observation, what they're building doesn't sound so bad. What's basically here is, hey, let's build a really safe, really well-made, concrete, newest technology. Take the newest technology and let's build a fantastic, great place. Somewhere where we might like to get our names down for possibly having a flat if we lived in those days. How can I get there? That sounds really good. That sounds really safe. And we kind of get this idea that there are things that could possibly be good in some scenarios, but in the inward heart, there might be something wrong. So is it wrong to want to live in a safe place? Well, no, we all want to live in a safe place with the newest technology. We all get the newest technology as soon as it comes in, right? If we think this is good, we're gonna bring it to our house. And is that wrong? Well, the answer is it depends on what the reason you're doing this is for. So, you know, we can have a savings account that we never touch. And the reason we never touch that savings account is because, well, you never know. There might be a rainy day. There might be something going wrong. We might need money or we might have it for retirement. That's good planning. But if the reason for that bank account is now I no longer have to trust God, not good planning. See, it's a good thing, but now it's bad in the wrong context, just depending on where our hearts are at with it. And so they actually say, let's stay together. Let's not disperse. We don't want that. that would be a terrible thing. And, you know, that's actually exactly the reverse of what God said. Go out and disperse, he said. He said to Ham and to Shem and to Japheth, he said, you guys go out into all the corners of the world and find your new homes. Go disperse and don't stay together, you three. Well, here they are. And what happens? They come right down the mountain. They see this vast, beautiful plain with these two beautiful rivers that they could live right in between. And they say, we're not going anywhere. No way are we going to let God disperse us. And so actually we get this idea that they take God's command rather skeptically, don't they? They're not the first people that look at the Bible and look at what God says to do and say, oh, why would I have to do that? Here it is, right? They look and they say, oh, I don't want to live. They have just one command at this point, really. Go out and disperse. And they say, no, that's not in our best interest. We're going to stay right here. We're not going to go out. We're going to be nice and safe. And so we get this idea already that something's not quite right in their heart. And then they say, let's build this tower that reaches to the heavens, right? And it goes sky high. And it really, it's this picture of tremendous arrogance, right? But it's an arrogance that we can relate to because people come to London to see our skyline. You know, people will come to visit and they'll go, don't miss out. Don't miss out on the grand skyline. You go and see it. So we know how to do this. We know about building towers. In fact, I think that there's some sort of competition going around on the world. Who can build the biggest one? There's really no reason to build a tower higher than the one that we've currently built. No one can go up there. It's not like you're going to have a big business up there and make lots of money, except for if people want to go see it and that's it. And yet we keep building bigger and bigger towers, sky high. We're going to get them up into the stratosphere, we say. We know what it is that they're trying to do. Make my name great. And they say, we'll go up to the heaven. And I think that's really a wonderful statement about their theology here. The life view is this. I don't need you, God. I can make my own way up. I can make my own way up. Now, we're not continuing the Genesis series for a little while, but we're going to find out that there's a stairway that comes down from heaven. That God says, I'll come down and I'll provide you a way up. But our culture is full with the notion, hey, there might be a problem with humankind. There might be a problem with the way we are, but we can fix it on our own. We can write a book. We can figure this out. We can go and read these things. We can get a bigger perspective. We can figure this out on our own. No necessary action from God. We can build a tower to heaven. By the way, these would be called ziggurats. If anybody wants to go and look out what these look like, they're not the little spindly thing. Whenever they do the Tower of Babel, they make that really cool circular, not very well structured picture. That's not it at all. So go and take a look at the ziggurat. You'll see there are tons of towers that are supposed to be up in the heavens. And the reason they're up there is exactly what they say. We're going to be near the gods up in the heavens. We'll make our way up to being in their presence. And we don't need God's help. They're making an alternative salvation. Now notice God brings these proud ones down. He brings the proud down. We see this in verse 5. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. And the Lord said, if, as one people speaking the same language, they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth. They stopped building the city. That is why it's called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So I love the irony here. It says that God is in heaven and then he needs to come down to see the tower. Okay. He's like, what is that down there? I can't see it. Where's my telescope? No, still not clear. I better take a trip down to see this tower of theirs. And so he comes down, probably a great deal far down, right? He goes, oh, they're building a tower, are they? They're building a tower. Great. Now, it says there that nothing will be impossible for them. You know, it's not that God is afraid that he's about to lose a fight with these people, that nothing will, that they're gonna actually build themselves a tower to heaven. They're going to actually occupy the courts of heaven. They're going to succeed if they stay together. That's not what's being said. They're going to succeed at what they're planning to do. And so what God is bothered about is that they will, in fact, be successful at building the city. They'll be successful at building this tower. And in so doing, they will waste their life on a distraction instead of being with him. That's what he's bothered about. They're going to succeed at living their lives without me. And I don't want it. And that is the danger of pride. The more pride you have, the less ability you want to really seek and know the living God. You're too busy being focused on you. And, you know, for each of us, there is a tower. There is a tower. Each person is tempted. Their imaginations are allured by something that, if they were to get it, would lead them far from God. You have a tower. I certainly have a tower. We have towers. Things that are well-crafted. Maybe it's not a building. Maybe it's something else. All around society, there are towers. We have towers on our bills. We have towers on our money. We have towers. We are so grand and great. And if we were to focus on that, it would lead us far from God. I had a friend of mine who showed up to seminary, went to seminary together, and he was very sad and very confused when he arrived. And the reason for this sadness and confusion is that he was a professional electric guitar player, and people didn't know how good he was. So you would listen to perhaps Joe Satriani, if you know who that is, extremely good at playing the electric guitar. Amazing things that he would do. It was unbelievable. And I would listen to a few of his albums. And since I play the electric guitar, I actually know that they're super, super good. Amazingly good. And what had happened is he was playing this and he was making gigs and he was making records. And then his hand began to hurt. And then over the course of a period of time, he suddenly wasn't able to play the electric guitar anymore. And so his dream, everything that he had planned for life, was just flushed. And it was the end of his idol. And when he showed up to seminary, he was confused. But he was open to God. He was open to God, and God took his life and renewed it and set him up for something much better than being a rock star. We all have a tower. What's yours? So God disperses them. It's a hilarious picture. He comes down and confuses their language. And so some guy says, hey, mate, can you pass me the hammer? And the guy responds, Maze, lama hamila halili, ani lo mabin otam. What are you saying? I don't understand your words, right? It's hilarious. What's this? Yeah, it's this fanciful picture. But is it real? I mean, this is a crazy story. Is this just something the Bible throws in to explain why we all speak in different languages? Well, we don't believe things just to believe them. Our faith is based on these historical events that God has said has taken place. And so if you were to look at the Middle East, there's a place called Erdu, and it's also called, in multiple sources outside of the Bible, Babel, okay? And at Erdu, there is a tremendous and gigantic base for what will be the world's first ziggurat. It's the very first of towers, really. But that base is abandoned. In fact, the entire city is completely abandoned. And the pottery that was at Erdu finds its way all over the Middle East within a few decades of that. And so we see, and further, if you go look at the ziggurat travels all over the world. You can find the ziggurat shape in Americas. You can find the ziggurat shapes everywhere. Okay. So these people are dispersed. It's really clear that something has happened. So go and look at that. But notice the last thing here. They say, let us make a name for them ourselves. But God gives them a name. He says, it's called Babel. And it means their language was confused. It's shame. The name that they get is shame. They tried to make a name. They tried to make a reputation. And here's what God says. No way. I will bring you down. So God always brings down the proud. There's no one who's going to escape this. If you happen to be the proud person, if you happen to be the person who thinks, I have 2 feet to stand on, watch out. Because God takes initiative to bring you down. Why does he do that? Because he loves you. He doesn't want you wasting your life on you. That's far too shallow. Now, let's consider another group. Yes, God always brings down the proud, but he always also lifts up. He gives a name. He blesses those who kind of admit they're humble. They admit their humility of their situation. They admit the reality of who they are. So in verse 10 through 26, which Martin read so wonderfully and which I'm not going to read again, but we have the genealogy of the line of Shem. And that word Shem, it means name or reputation. So here's a person who God is going to give a reputation to, right? We have them saying, let's make a Shem for ourselves. And God says, no. And now he says, here's somebody I'll give a Shem to. I'll give a reputation to. I'll give a name to. And then verses 27 through 32, we have of the line of Shem, we have this person named Terah, from which Abraham comes. And who is Abraham? He is the hero of Genesis, okay? He is the man of faith that God desires all of us to be. He's the example that he's asking us to take on. So this is all leading to Abraham, this line all the way through Seth, right? Seth, Noah, Abraham, eventually to Jesus, okay? Now, what can we say about these genealogies? First, we see the devastating sin of man in the lessening of life is actually a gift, okay? So each child that lives subsequently in this line lives a little bit less than their parents. So you start off with Shem and he lives, 700 years. Well, Noah lived 1,000. And then the next one, right, it just keeps going down and down and down. And if you follow the logic, eventually we're going to get down to the normal lifespan that we have, the very short normal lifespan. Now, we know that this is the consequence of sin. God says, I'm not going to strive forever. The years of their life will be 120 years. But I want to say that this is also a blessing. Well, how could this possibly be a blessing? Why would having a shorter life be good? Well, a couple things. The first is, I don't have to live 1,000 years with my nasty, mucky inner problem. That inner problem that you have today, that you can't seem to change. The thing that you wish after a time, you can change the manifestation of it to something more applicable, that something the world says that's okay, but you can't really change the nature of doing bad things. And it just, when you do the bad things, it's even worse over time. That to be stuck with that for 1,000 years is pretty hopeless. And that's what happened before the flood. And guess what happened because that was the case? Most people didn't believe in God. Most people aren't following the Lord because their flesh just rules them. And that's why the flood was a good thing. And that's why limiting their life was a good thing and not a bad thing. But secondly, it brings us to a point of weakness. See, God is weakening man here. He is purposely weakening man. And that's good. Our lives are short. We better prepare for eternity. Our lives are short. We have no choice about it. And we are in a weak state. The frailty of man, you can read a million books on it, and they're all designed to drag us to God. It's better to be weak. Verse 27, let's look at Terah's line, and we're going to see that his line is characterized by weakness. Verse 27. This is the account of Terah's family line. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran became the father of Lot. While his father, Terah, was still alive, Haran died in Ur of Chaldeans in the land of his birth. Abraham and Nahor both married, The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, the father of both Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was childless because she had not been able to conceive. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, a son of Haran, his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abraham, and together they set out from Ur of Chaldeas to go to Canaan, or to Israel, to go to Israel. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years, and he died in Haran. So the first thing that we'll notice is that we have these people living for a long time. 200 years is at the end of this, right? And yet, Terah's son dies in his father's presence in unknown circumstances. And that is this tragedy. It's a terrible, terrible moment for someone to lose a child and not to see themselves grow old and know that they will continue on. It's a horrible and sad situation. Well, likely from that situation, but also something else kind of propels them to get up and to go to what is modern day Israel, okay, Canaan. We find something interesting on this. Later on, we're told that God says to Abram, I appeared to you in Ur, that's the place that is mentioned here where Terah is at, and I appeared and told you to go to Canaan. So God appeared to Abram and told him to go to Canaan. But here it says that Terah and Abraham, actually Terah said, you guys, let's all go to Canaan. So it's fairly likely that God appeared not just to Abraham, but to Terah. And he said, yeah, make a start, make a fresh start, get out of this town, go to this land, and I will bless you there. But something happens. Terah gets up and he goes. And then he runs into a place called Haran, okay? And Haran was like the Las Vegas of its day. It was like Ibiza. It was like Monaco. It was like party central, but particularly it was party central with the moon god attached to it. It was a moon god worship cult center. Now, Terah's name is the name for the moon god, okay? And his kids are named after the moon god. And so what has happened is, God, the real living God, has possibly appeared to Abraham and to Terah and said, go, but Terah gets caught in his favorite vice. And there he stays, and there he dies. He gets caught in his favorite idol. So we have towers that we build that keep us away from God, and now we have idols that we love that keep us away from the promised land. What's your idol? What's your tower? But also, look, Abraham comes from people who are, you know, given and prone to wickedness. He's needy and he's sinful, just like everyone else. He comes from sinful people, and that turns out to be really important. Now, look, Abraham's wife is barren, and Avram is what it says here, which means father of a exalted father is what it means. And that must have been a hilarious conversation. Oh, what's your name? Avram. Oh, really? Exalted father. So how many kids do you have?
None.
Oh. So is it your father that's exalted? Or are you, why are you called that? Yeah. Like, why is that your name? Because, you know, you're not going to go on. You're not even a father, really. It's this point of weakness. In fact, it looks like the family line is basically dried up. And they need help. And that's exactly the point. The kind of people that God helps are those in weakness. They come in weakness. They know they're weak. They look for help. They look for salvation. Spurgeon said, the only thing that qualifies us for the gospel is that we're sinners. That's what he says. It's not that we've done something. It's not that we did enough good deeds, right, to merit. I didn't show up to church every Sunday. I didn't pay the right tithes. I didn't do any of that. I'm a sinner. And Spurgeon says, that's right. And now the gospel is for you. That's who it's for. It's for people who are needy. Well, here we have some needy people. Perhaps God will exalt them. Perhaps God will lift them up. Actually, that's God's heart. Paul, I will gladly boast in my weaknesses. For when I'm weak, then he is strong. And so this is not just true for them. It's true for all who have faith. God will lift you up the more you're cognizant and come to him with your weaknesses, the more he will empower you to change them. There's no way you're going to change the problems of your life by thinking your way through them. You must have God change you. Don't build yourself a tower. Let God build you a name. So that's our message. God brings down the proud, but lifts up the humble. So first, in application, what is your tower? What is your idol? What is it that you crave that keeps you from God's presence? Can I ask you to go and make war against it? Go and make war against your favorite carnal pride. Go and make war against your favorite enticing idol, because it is designed to take you from God's presence. And you will have none of that, because God is your salvation. Go and make war. How do I fight pride? It's really hard, isn't it? It's so easy to make ourselves the center of the world. It happens by default. We just want everything ordered exactly the way we'd like. The way we fight pride is by making much of God. It's not by focusing on pride and saying, I'm going to be less prideful, because that involves a bit of pride. You're thinking about how you're going to be less prideful, you know, because I got to do this for me. Yeah. But when we say, I will make God much, I will make much of God, I will focus my day on him, I will focus my life on him, then we find that our prideful moments don't really fit and that we don't want to bother with that junk. I'm too busy making the love of Christ known to have a special moment where I say, aren't I great? Now, can we all applaud me? No, don't applaud me. Applaud Christ. That's the way out from pride. Lastly, we can glory in our weakness. We can glory in our weakness. You know, we do not have to have it together. We don't have to sit down at the right time or stand up right at the right time. We don't have to have the affection of our fellow peers. We don't have to make a great name for ourselves. We don't have to, be remembered well. It doesn't really matter what people think. What matters is if God helps us or not. Just let that sink. It doesn't matter what they think. You know what's interesting about this story? Everyone knew about Babel. All of the ancient people knew about Babel. Barely anybody knew of anything about Shem. And this man, Abraham, nobody knows about him. Nobody knows a thing about Abram. He's a virtual unknown during the course of his life. And yet, we all know about him now because God wants us to replicate his faith. God will make in you a lasting name as you allow yourself to be weak and for him to save you. Let's pray and we'll conclude this message.